Right now, I have on the line Steve Goodall. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you tonight?
Well, very good. Thank you very much, Steve. And thank you very much for the interview. And what a story you have.
Yeah, it's pretty pretty fantastic. Pretty sad, actually.
Well, that's it, isn't it? It's good and it's sad. I mean, that will come out as we talk about it, but it's something you have some chagrin over, I would say, what has happened to you.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It changed my life. You know, it's just my lifestyle, you know, really, I think is the cause of this. And so I'm an active participant.
Right. You can't go back now.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, then, I mean, it's interesting. We have to credit George Bush, it seems, with actually what has occurred to you.
Well, actually, I think you need to give him a lot of credit on a lot of levels. One is the killing of the renewable energy business,
yeah,
when he was first elected, and which I was actively involved in. And we felt like we were off to a good start. We were, of course, lagging a bit. Mm-hmm. But with his election in 2000, it pretty much killed the whole industry. And now we're trying to desperately recover from that. But it set us back just far enough, unfortunately, to, I think, put us over the cliff.
Yeah.
And I have my doubts whether, you know, we can recover.
Well, unfortunately, you know, I'm an engineer, and when I look at the numbers, they don't look good.
No, they don't. And, you know, when you try to explain that to a beautiful group of people that have never used fossil fuels, you know, you can't do that without taking a certain amount of responsibility for it.
Yes.
And, in my case, that's, you know, especially true because when I was 18, I went to Alaska and went to work on the Trans-Alaskan pipeline to help bring that oil down here so that we could burn it and put it in our atmosphere and pollute the planet and in turn, you know, cause the destruction of the most beautiful islands, you know, I have ever seen.
And, of course, wreak Sarah Palin on us as well.
Yeah, Sarah Palin. Let's not even go there.
So from that point, when you did that, how did your life develop and where did it take you? What was your moral compass then?
Well, you know, I've always had this big sense of responsibility for the condition of our planet and really ashamed of, you know, the human race, really, and how we might be the ones to cause so much destruction. And so when I left in 2004, I tried to sail away from those thoughts. And unfortunately, everywhere I went, you keep running into, especially the low-lying islands, you know, you can't visit them and see their beauty without realizing that their time is, they don't have much time left, basically.
Yeah.
So I had, you know, all through the Caribbean and across the Pacific, on the low-lying islands, I would talk to the people and just ask them if they were making any plans, if they knew about sea level rise. And but, you know, to be honest with you, I wasn't that concerned with the people on those islands because they're all so westernized. Everywhere you go anymore, if there's a landing strip there, the first thing they do is fly in fossil fuels and outboard engines and white rice. And it doesn't take long for the people abandon their traditional ways. So, you know, I always felt that these people could actually move anywhere in the Western world and they would be, you know, they would fit right in.
Okay.
Until I got to these atolls where I made the film.
Can you describe where the, I mean, they're so remote, it might be hard to describe where they are even.
Well, you just go to Hawaii, and then you just keep on going. They're about 4,000 miles west of Hawaii. And their remoteness is really what has protected them and what has allowed their village lifestyle to continue for, you know, 3,000 years, virtually untouched. They're so far off the beaten path that even you know, people on sailboats, which we call ourselves cruisers, we don't usually go there because they're very difficult to reach. And you're planning your sailing trips mainly around the storm seasons, which would be the typhoons over there, cyclones in the southern hemisphere, and hurricanes as we know them, but it's all the same storm.
Right.
So typically when you sail across the Pacific, you end up going to Tahiti and then like Tonga and Fiji, and then you head south to New Zealand or Australia, and you spend the cyclone season there and in relative safety. So once you're that far east, it's very hard to sail back west and north to get to these atolls. So what I did is I spent the cyclone season in Tonga and just kept a close eye on the weather, and luckily we didn't have any major storms that year. And then I went north from there. So
was it just, you just said, oh, when there's a little speck there, I want to go see it, or you just, well, that looks interesting, I'm going to go there? Or?
Well, I always wanted to go to Micronesia, but when I was in Fiji, we had a decent internet connection. So I went on Google Earth, which was relatively new at that time, and looked at all the islands in Micronesia that had, you know, decent anchorage. And really, that's the key when you're out sailing, especially in the middle of nowhere. You have to have some protection from the sea if you want to, you know, toss out your hook. So these islands are just amazing for that. They all have inner lagoons and a protective landmass. And they're just unbelievably beautiful. You know, when you look at them from Google Earth, and you can see that on my website. I actually have some Google Earth shots of them.
Oh, wonderful. Can you maybe describe how you first, you know, just the view as you slid into the island with your boat?
Yeah, it's just amazing. Well, any landfall is pretty exciting, but this was especially exciting because they're so remote. And just the warmth of the people, they come out, there's also some pictures of them, you know, coming out in their canoes to my boat, and they just have huge smiles on their faces, and they're just so welcoming. And the first question they ask is, you know, how many people are on board? And they're pretty surprised when they find out you're sailing solo. And for one reason is their own sailboats take, you know, massive amounts of manpower to sail. So, they don't believe you at first. You're by yourself. But, yeah, it's, God, they're just so fantastic. And then you typically, you anchor, and then you go to shore, and you find the chief, and you ask him permission, of course, to visit his island, and typically you bring a gift for him of some kind. But, you know, access is never denied. They're just happy to have you. And then you get to go around, and everybody greets you, and it's absolutely an amazing experience.
And especially in an untouched island, I mean, I presume they have no TV, there's no cars, there's no fuel, they don't use any hydrocarbons, is that correct?
They don't. They're basically, and because they're so far out of reach, and they don't have any natural resources to exploit. So that's why they were never really put on any shipping routes or anything like that. They're relatively small. And still, they're the home of the celestial navigators, which is the practice of navigating long distances only using the stars and the sea and the sun. They don't have a compass even on their ships. So this is a skill that's taught from generation to generation, and they still do it there.
So they sail, what, for hunt? Go. I mean, there's no nearby islands. They have to go, what, hundreds of miles to in a rowboat, basically?
Yeah, it's they're actually very sophisticated. You know, they're hand-carved sailing canoes. But they're very sophisticated. They're the same style that the Lapita navigators first developed about 3,000 years ago in Papua New Guinea, originally, I believe. And they use that canoe and that navigation techniques to pollinate the entire Pacific, you know, from Tahiti to Hawaii and all those islands. Originally, those people are from Papua New Guinea.
It still works then.
Oh, yeah, it still works. It works great. You know, I certainly wouldn't have gone to sea, especially by myself, without GPS, let alone, you know, without a compass.
Exactly. Incredible. Yeah. So you float into this literally a paradise. You're in. But then what's the first inkling that things aren't quite aren't what they seem?
Well, you know, I knew that going in because I was in the renewable energy business. So before I even left, I was very, you know, hip to climate change and sea level rise. But here, I had a hard time talking to the people about it because I realized, you know, they didn't know really the future, and you know, they don't use money, they don't have any money because they don't need it, and you know, they're so remote. Wow. So it took me over 2 weeks, and I would, you know, to talk to them. I became very good friends with the young chief Yoki, and every day I would just, you know, well, every night I would just torment myself. I've got to tell him. I've got to tell him, you know, tomorrow. And then tomorrow would come, and I just, it's hard to find the right opportunity to tell someone that, you know, their lifestyle is going to be over and that I'm the guy that, you know, takes a lot of large responsibility and why it's over. So finally, I did. I spit the words out, and he immediately reacted. He jumped up and said, you know, that's what's happening to us. And then he ran across the island and grabbed the other chief and grabbed their master navigator, Rapui, and brought them both back and said, you know, tell them what you just told me. And so I did. And so they just basically, they just freaked out because they realized that it had been happening, but they didn't realize that it was going to get worse.
Wow. So what had been happening on the island? What had they noticed?
Well, the main thing, I mean, they have shore erosion, and it's obvious everywhere you look because all the palm trees have, you know, fallen into the sea, and they've had to relocate a lot of their homes that were close to the sea, and some of them they actually built up on stilts. But the main problem that they're facing is the seawater has infiltrated their freshwater supply. And their crops are all dying. Their main crop is taro. And it's basically like a potato, similar to, well, not really, like a, I don't know, it's a root crop. But it looks like a philodendron to me, a giant philodendron.
Okay.
But it grows in, it's called swamp taro, and it grows in the freshwater lens on the inside of the inner part of their island. So the seawater's infiltrated that freshwater lens, and all their taro is dying. So in the film, you can see these little inland lakes. They're like swamps, and they used to be completely filled with the taro crop, and now they're just barren, and you can see the dying palm trees and the banana trees. I mean, everything is dying there because of the saltwater infiltration.
Well, so their very water supply is imperiled then.
Yeah, exactly. And they don't have a spring there. All their water is rainwater that is collected on top of this coral lens.
Ooh.
So it is, you know, like a groundwater, and they have some wells going down to it, but it's actually all rainwater that's collected over the millennium.
Over the millennium, this is ancient water we're talking about.
Yeah, and you know, with every storm, I guess it replenishes to some extent. But so, I mean, they could have, if we supplemented their food out there, they could probably, you know, and I'm just guessing because there's so many variables, but they might have, you know, 10 or 20 more years before, you know, they lose enough land to where they have to move. But really, you know, their days of being self-sufficient are over. The main peril they face, I think, other than their food supply, is they're so susceptible to storm damage. You know, the typhoons are getting worse and worse every year.
Right.
In fact, this year, that last one hit the Philippines.
Oh, yeah.
And it was very late in the season, and it was very close to the equator where it started. So it's a very atypical storm. That and then a tsunami.
Oh my gosh.
You know, that luckily that one that hit in Japan, that was like directly north of them. So the tsunami did not go to the south. They're totally vulnerable, and it would take you know, a week to get there any emergency supply. So they're, you know, they're very vulnerable.
Well, that's it. So there you are. You've told them that you've just given, you know, the bad news, literally, that they are on life support, and there's it's gonna, and the plugs are gonna be pulled. That's when your life changed.
Yeah, it totally changed, because then they asked me, well, what are we going to do? My background has been in large construction projects and in, you know, dealing with government agencies and environmental concerns. So, I mean, I have a pretty good grip on the reality of what they're facing. You know, their first thought was, well, why can't you stop, you know, climate change? And so I had to explain that. And then was, well, can't we do anything? You know, can we build up our island? Because of my background in construction, I knew that wasn't feasible. So the only thing I could think of was, you know, I had a small, a little funky handy cam on board. So I started to shoot some. I said, well, you know, I'll take your statements. And then I'll come back to the States and I'll try and get some help, maybe a National Geographic or somebody to go, you know, cover this story. So I shot some footage, and then I went back to the boat, and I thought, okay, now where am I going to sail, you know, to leave my boat and come back to the States? And that's where it really dawned on me how far away they were from everything. So I decided that I would sail back to an island that had a port, which was the island of Chuuk, and just order the camera gear myself, and then shoot some footage, and then, you know, basically bring enough footage to document their story back to the States. And I did that. It took 3 months to get the camera equipment to the island of Chuuk.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
The veritable slow boat to China.
It was. So then I went back through the islands and ended up sailing from island to island with that Chief Yoki. And basically, they are, these five islands that are covered in the film, they are a community amongst themselves. And, I mean, they marry from island to island. It's matriarchal society, so typically you stay on the island where your wife lives. And so it was fascinating, because I got to see this, a real village, the workings of it. And when you see it, you see the selflessness of these people, and really they're not concerned about their own well-being. They're concerned about their village first and foremost. And it's just, it's so beautiful and so touching. And apparently I was able to capture a lot of that in the film, because people come to me and just, you know, they're just really touched by these people like I was.
So. Oh, yeah, I saw it last year at Nevada City, the film, and it stayed with me very, very strongly. It's just so powerful.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, the people just radiate this. And when you see their concern, when they're talking about it, when they realize what's happening, it's really amazing. I mean, there's very little blame put out to whose fault this is or anything else, but they're appealing for some help.
Well, that's it, and that changed your life in terms of to help them, to save them, to give them an alternative. And how was that for you? I mean, emotionally, you must have got so connected with, you know, just bringing them that information, and you must have felt responsible.
Oh, yeah, and I still do, and I'm very disappointed that I've been unable to really get a lot of support for them. It's, you know, it definitely changed my life. I was, you know, not planning on coming back. I was going to sail, you know, for the rest of my life, as far as I was concerned. And I ended up parking my boat in Palau and coming back and making this film. And that's another irony, is really it cost me you know, my savings and my boat. I sold my boat to make the film, and I have not been able to raise any money for these people. So, you know, really, I should have just given them the money. I should have. I found a place for them to move on the island of Yap. And really, if I would have known, I would have just spent my money, you know, helping them move to the island of Yap instead of making a film.
Wow.
And I think a lot of people, you know, like myself, I'd never made a documentary film before. And we think that if we see a subject covered on TV in a documentary on PBS, we think, oh, yeah, that's great. You know, somebody's helping these people, and, you know, that's a horrible situation they're in. But good thing, help must be on the way. But that's absolutely not true. And I think it's less true for most causes, because most pieces are done by journalists. And just by their nature and their profession, they cover a story and they move on.
Right.
I consider myself an activist, so I'm sticking with the story, and I'm, you know, I'm not going to give up. I may not succeed, but I'm not going to give up trying to help these people. So I think a lot of us are under the illusion that if it's documented and if it gets a certain amount of exposure, then, oh, well, that's another problem that's being taken care of. But a la contraire.
Interesting, yeah, that well, obviously you did get them, did go to Yap, and the government there did acknowledge what was happening to those islanders and offered to help. How has that worked out? Has that been stalled because of the money?
Yeah, it has on, you know, on any level of actually doing any construction or building any infrastructure. But they came up with some land, and they actually did a study themselves on where the sea level rise is projected to go on the island of Yap, and how much of their crops are going to be underwater, and continuing the study on, you know, how many crops they're going to need to feed their entire population, where they're going to move, you know, their existing crops. But they've taken it very seriously, and it's just so amazing. These people in Yap are just unbelievable. They immediately said, of course, these people can come here. Wow. I mean, there was just no hesitation from the governor to the senators, everyone. And they've followed through on that. But unfortunately, their entire gross national product is about $18 million a year.
Mm.
And, you know, the infrastructure to move between 2,000 and 4,000 people there, I mean, that could easily, you know, take half of that.
Right.
So.
Very easily.
Yeah. So, you know, they're, I think, on some level counting on me also to try and drum enough support for them, you know, to try and get the government, our government, to take a look at them. And now, I mean, I do have some hope because, you know, President Obama has come out publicly and acknowledged climate change.
Yes.
I think before, when I first tried to approach them and the ambassador, totally blew me off. And I think that was in part because if they acknowledged that these people were in trouble, they would have to acknowledge the whole scope of climate change. And I don't think they were ready to do that.
They didn't want to connect those dots together.
Right, exactly. So now, you know, I'm optimistic that they can take another look. They're looking on the long-term effects, but they really need to look at the people that are being affected right now, you know, today. I've got a few groups. It's really a great little story. The film is showing on the documentary channel, and a Girl Scout named Abby in North Carolina saw it on TV, and she made it one of her merit badges. So she organized a showing. I did a Skype interview and at her church, and now she's organized another showing with another Girl Scout in Auburn, California. I'm hoping that the Girl Scouts can get further with the administration than I did. But it's just so amazing. I mean, the children, our children, are the ones that immediately don't have any political aspirations and aren't contaminated with all the rhetoric and the propaganda, basically, that climate change is not real, it's not happening, and they immediately respond when they see these people in distress that, oh, my God, we have to do something. So my prayers are going out to them. I hope they can succeed where I haven't.
Isn't that interesting? I've heard that from other activists that kids are the ones who are really triggering things now.
Yeah, they are. And, you know, it's their future that we've messed with here.
Right.
And, you know, messed with in a horrible, horrible way. And I apologize to any young people that are listening to this, because I'm a child of the 70s, really, and things seemed to be going so well with my generation, and we got rid of Nixon.
Right.
We had the EPA, and they started shutting down major polluters, and,
right,
you know, the environmental movement took on. Then I think we made some mistakes, and everybody branched off, including myself, and we had our pet projects. And mine was, you know, to save Lake Tahoe. A lot of people were the sea lions and
whales, or whatever.
Yeah, the whales, the owls, the certain fish species. I mean, we all branched off, and those are all very good projects.
Right.
But we missed the big picture, and that was climate change.
Mm.
And by doing that, we ended up jeopardizing all of those species that we are trying to protect. All of the redwood forest. I mean, you can just go down the list. And climate change is going to affect every one of those. And, I mean, if you took a look at it, all the money that we've spent and all the man hours that all these wonderful people, environmentalists, have spent saving each of their own pet projects.
Right.
If we would have concentrated on climate change, I think we could have whipped it a long time ago, and then we could have gone off and done these other things. And, you know, that hasn't changed. Still trying to save each individual species one by one. And I think we need to get together. We all need to go to, you know, 350.org or one of those organizations. That's the one that I follow the most.
Yeah.
And we need to put our support, you know, big time behind this one major issue. And then we can go from there. But I think that's where we really missed the boat.
Yeah, because it is the blanket issue. You know, our energy usage is really what has driven us to this point.
Yeah.
And we have to face that as we drive in our cars, yeah. But now, for you, you know, where is your life? You know, you made the film, and you got a lot of attention. You've been in various festivals and on documentary channel. Where do you see yourself going now?
Well, I'm still doing it. I'm still on the circuit. I just showed the film at University of Nevada in Las Vegas night before last, doing radio interviews, speaking in classrooms, and still showing in film festivals around the world. I'm still doing that, but I'm also, I'm trying to bring a few of the island people themselves over here to the U.S. And, you know, I want to, well, let me back up a little bit. If they move, and when they move to Yap, I'm just afraid that they're going to be westernized.
Yeah.
You know, Yap is pretty much westernized, and the conditions to which they're going to have to move to, they're going to require fossil fuel inputs and power and sewer and all that. So they're not going to be able to move anywhere they go. They're not going to be able to resume their lifestyle. As I say in the film, it's very tragic to lose these beautiful islands, but the real tragedy is to lose the village. And, you know, these people have one of the very last villages, true villages, left on the planet. And that's what I'm afraid is going to slip away under the sea.
Right.
What I'd like to do, and what I'm trying to do, is to bring a group of them here, and let's have a discussion. Let's bring some scholars in. I've got some Native Americans from the Washoe tribe in where I'm from, Lake Tahoe. They want to have a powwow, as they call it. And let's take a look at what it takes to make a real village. And let's try and analyze this so we don't let it slip away under the sea with these islands. You know, the Native Americans, they had a village just a little over 100 years ago.
Right.
And when you talk to their cultural people, and, you know, I'll say to them that you guys used to have a village, but you don't anymore. And you can just see it immediately. They're like, oh, my God, you know, we don't have a village anymore.
Right.
And they know exactly what you're talking about. They know what they've lost. And,
yeah,
I mean, that's another huge tragedy of what we've done to the Native Americans. We didn't just destroy these nations. We destroyed hundreds of real villages, and we did it systematically.
Obviously, 100 years ago, we had the example of Ishi. If you know that story, you know, the last remaining wild Indian who was brought to captivity. And there is always that insensitivity from that to be careful of, obviously.
Absolutely amazing stories. The more I get into the research, it just the more my heart breaks, if you can imagine that.
As you said, a matriarchal island, something where their traditions hadn't changed in literally thousands of years. I mean, oh, it's just given me chills just thinking about that place.
Yeah, and, you know, it was so difficult to tell them, right, about it and to accept the responsibility. But then on one island, and I don't really cover this in the film, the island of Ifaluk, I had made the rounds, and they made me show, you know, and talk to everyone on the whole island, just from the children to the seniors. They didn't leave anybody out. So it was a couple days after I had told them, given them the information and told them about it, and I was in one of the men's houses, which is like a shelter where the men gather and build canoes and make their twine ropes and, you know, just have their BS.
Right. There was it their den, you know, man den thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Man cave, yeah.
And, you know, always the atmosphere in these settings were just so jovial, and, you know, their sense of humor is what really bonded me to them. I mean, it was just like sitting around with some of my buddies up at Tahoe, my ski buddies and something, right? So, anyway, they were having a heated discussion. It was the first time in like 4 months of being from island to island that I'd heard anything like this. And they were speaking in their own language, so I asked my friend, the interpreter, I said, you know, what's going on? And he said, well, they're having a discussion. The chief wants them to shut down this part of the reef. And I'm like, well, of course, because that's their tradition. They fish a certain part of the reef for a couple of weeks. They close it. They open another reef, and then they fish that, and they close it. And they just keep moving it around so they don't, you know, over-harvest the fish.
Right.
I said, well, of course, that's what you guys do, right? And he said, yeah, but these guys are saying, what's the point? It's all going to be underwater. So here, me giving them this news, I had now influenced a 3,000-year-old tradition.
Yeah.
It hit me like an arrow.
Yeah.
And I just said, well, you know, you can't. I said, please don't change. You know, I wanted to say, maybe it won't happen, right? But I couldn't say that because I know it is happening.
Yeah.
I didn't know what to say. I just said, please don't change what you're doing because of me.
Oh, dear. Well, as I say, it's better that you came by and told them than then standing up to their necks in water and wondering what's happening.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I definitely believe that. They're very smart people. They're very capable people. And as long as they have the information, at least it gives them a fighting chance.
Exactly. Well, thank you for doing this and making it your life's work, and it is so thoroughly deserving of it, and we need to hold onto these cultures and what the remnants of this earth, and thank you for doing that, Steve. Can you let people know how they can contact you or get involved?
Oh, sure. Our website is someplacewithamountain.org, just one word. And can view the film there, and you know, you can make. I have a nonprofit that I deal with. If you know, if someone wanted to contribute to them, that'd be fantastic. Or even just buying a copy of the film there. That supports my efforts to, you know, get the word out and to help them. So,
yeah.
But you know, go see the film.
Yeah.
You know, go there, view the film, and learn about these people, because they're very special, and you know, we've got to re-examine our lifestyle on many different levels.
Yeah. And I know it's the harbinger of bad news, but thank you for bringing it to us, and thank you for your great work.
Yes, well, thank you very much for this interview. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve Goodall. Someplace with a Mountain.